Your skin is clammy. This grit behind your eyeballs. A solitary owl hoots. The world lays creepily silent. Then a shadowy figure emerges from the darkness.
The problem is 99% of the planet doesn't know who he is.
Who is that guy?
A rebel. A guardian of everything that's fair in this dog-eat-dog world. One man with an opinion, a studio hotline, and 5 hours to kill.
Let's do this then.
Around Australia on the Triple M Network. Triple M. Welcome to The Night Shift with Luke Boner.
You right to go, Jess? You're right, are you? Good. Just checking. Good morning, Australia. How are you? Welcome to Tuesday, November 14, and another night shift as we keep each other company through the wee small hours of the morning. What we uncover in the next 5.5 hours is anybody's guess. It's always a surprise, but it's always interesting. And why don't you contribute? The open line gets very, very busy, and it's always a good idea to get in first. So jump on board, 133353. That's the number, hasn't changed. Good morning to all of you who have contributed to our Facebook page over the last 24 hours. It is there, The Night Shift on Triple M. You can tweet us at MMM Night Shift, or you can email nightshift@triplem.com.au. But I keep saying it, we are a radio talk program. The idea is to talk on the radio, so why don't you do just that? 133353, Jesse is ready to go. It always gets me really fired up when I read about animal cruelty. I know most of you listening in, big animal fans. Your pets mean everything to you, and it must make you absolutely sick to the core when you hear of extreme animal cruelty. And you find out that the perpetrators are escaping with just a slap on the wrist, and that's even repeat offenders. There was a story today about animal welfare groups who are demanding tougher penalties, and I couldn't go along with them any stronger. There is a new RSPCA warning that the community would be outraged if it knew the extent of the soft sentences that some people are getting. It was revealed yesterday that just 27 of 614 people convicted of animal cruelty over the past 5 years received any jail time. That is less than 5%. Less than 5%. And I was reading and I saw the photos. Just horrendous. Jess will put this on Facebook this morning. A Newcastle woman who starved her horse so badly its ribs were sticking right out. You could see them quite clearly. She was given a 3-month suspended sentence. And this feathery slap on the wrist was delivered in June, 2 years after she was convicted of cruelty for failing to provide vet treatment for the same horse's leg injury. Some people should not have pets. Some people should not be anywhere near animals. In November last year, I read a Goulburn man faced court after an RSPCA inspection found hundreds of dead sheep on his property. And hidden among the pile of carcasses, inspectors found a ewe still alive despite having been dragged 100 metres behind a quad bike, ripping off her skin down one side. I'm sorry if this is upsetting, but this is what some people are doing. Unfortunately, crows had pecked out one eye and the ewe had to be put down on the spot. The man got a 12-month suspended jail term. Well, why wouldn't you send these people to jail? And earlier last year, a Goulburn puppy farmer who pleaded guilty to animal cruelty involving 71 dogs and puppies, he got away with a good behaviour bond and some fines. Now, I'm no expert, but if you are unbelievably cruel to animals, are you not likely to be cruel to people. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but it just seems to me that if you're capable of committing these acts of cruelty, God knows what else you're capable of. In 2014, a Bidwell man, Jacob Vandershoot, then 22, slit his dog's throat with a boning knife and left it to die in agony, bleeding out in his front yard. He was given a year of community service despite pleading guilty. Anyway, we'll talk more about this later this morning, but the RSPCA's chief operating officer is Andrew Clatches. He said prosecution was a last resort, with only 1% of cases reaching court. He said, we see outrage from the community consistently in response to court sentences, but these people are getting off. And I don't get it. I just don't get it. As I said, Jess will put this story on our Facebook page a little bit later on. You have a look at it and have a read of it. Now, I'm sorry if it is offensive. It is really confronting. But I just cannot tolerate cruelty to animals. And it's very, very upsetting. But you may have some stories you'd like to share. You might like to tell me what you think. 133353 is the telephone number. Now, here is an excellent case of freedom of religion, freedom of speech. And what this man is actually preaching, I completely disagree with, but he has a right to say it. And I know that this is going to be controversial, but this is what we've been talking about for a long, long time. There is this hardline Islamic sheikh. He's been sacked from his day job for telling his followers that women need to wear the hijab so men can control their sexual urges. He's a Queensland Muslim leader, Sheikh Zainuddin Johnson, and was weighing into claims made against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein when he advised women that they needed to cover up. He said, quote, men should be able to control themselves. This is a common argument against the Islamic hijab, he told his Facebook followers. I totally agree. They should be able to control themselves. However, facts show many don't. This is why a hijab is necessary for women. Now, the Sunni Imam from the Logan Mosque south of Brisbane was sacked from his undisclosed private sector job 6 days after the Daily Mail broke the story. They sacked him because of the article, he said. Sheikh Johnson described his sacking as a freedom of speech issue. Do we really have freedom of religion? Do we really have freedom of speech? He asked his 4,923 Facebook friends. Should they be permitted by law to fire me based on speaking my beliefs? What he said, I find abhorrent. But we practice freedom of speech and freedom of religion in this country. And I'm putting it out there, he should not have been sacked by what he said on his Facebook. I completely disagree with what he said. But in this country, he has a right to say it. Do you agree or disagree? You tell me if I'm wrong. And if you think I'm wrong, I know you will tell me. And we got a lot of feedback on this today on Facebook, and I'll read you out some of the comments. If someone says something that you find abhorrent, like the fact that he says that women should cover up with a hijab because men can't control their urges, to me, that's just so wrong. But should he have been sacked for saying it? That's what we need to look at here. And I want to know what your thoughts are. 133353 is the telephone number. Has the Christmas Grinch hit your town or suburb or city? I was reading in the Herald Sun yesterday that the push to bring Christmas cheer to Lilydale could have been spoilt by bureaucratic red tape. And this is going to happen all over Australia between now and the 25th. Vic Rhodes has insisted the festive crew of 6 Yarra Valley residents who are collecting donations to decorate Lilydale's main street pay for a traffic assessment and road closures if they put up decorations. Basically, we've got a small group of people. They've raised $1,330, mostly through an online fundraising page and sausage sizzles. They paid $200 for a local company to do the assessment. and was sent to Vic Roads last week. According to Wandon's Amanda Young, Vic Roads gave the group just 2 weeks to put up the decorations. She said it could take up to 15 working days for the authority to decide on the plans. If the plans are approved, the group will also have to pay almost $500 to close off a lane of traffic on the Maroondah Highway while volunteers put up and then later take down the decorations. They've asked, could Vic Roads please waive the fees? She said she was disappointed with the response from Lilydale traders. Apart from Stockdale and Lego real estate agents, they gave $500. They said, "We have approached every business along the street and they won't donate. They're happy to have us decorate, but they didn't want to donate. I'm exhausted. I can't even get $5 from anyone." And she said after spending their donations on the traffic assessment and lane closures, it left little money for decorating. I understand that Vic Roads are now looking at waiving the costs, but only after pressure from the media. Have you had trouble putting Christmas spirit into your community? Give us a call, 1-3-3-5-3. Have we become so politically correct that we're scared? Are some of these shops not donating to pretty up the street and Christmas up the street because they're worried about offending people? What's your experience? Have you started decorating yet? What's the feeling among your community? 1-3-3-5-3 is the telephone number. And fancy Vic Roads putting all those fees because you want to decorate for Christmas. You just find roadblocks everywhere, don't you? More than half the traders won't donate a cent, and then you've got Vic Roads putting up all these roadblocks. I mean, they only raised $1,330. Sausage sizzles. The traders didn't want to donate, apparently. I wonder why. Give us a call. Let us know what's happening in your area, in your street, in your community. Is it Christmased up yet, or is it too early? 1-3-3-5-3 is the telephone number. Well, what do you do about Manus Island, eh? About 420 men have chosen to remain at the site, living without food or water or medical supplies for almost 2 weeks. Meanwhile, the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, says she has grave concerns with Australia's offshore detention centres. Ms. Ardern says refugees on Manus Island will be her sole focus when she meets with Malcolm Turnbull again this week. But her criticism of Australia's handling of the refugee crisis on the island, which she has described as unacceptable, has prompted a warning from New Zealand's opposition for her to tread very carefully, and she needs to do this. Ms. Ardern, on the weekend, has blasted Australia's handling of the issue. She says it's unacceptable, and she's pushing for New Zealand's offer to accept 150 refugees and asylum seekers from Australia's offshore detention centres. Now, I've said it before and I'll say it again. That all sounds very magnanimous, Ms. Ardern. But what signal does this then send other people who want to move here illegally? What signal does it send the people smugglers? And how many more deaths at sea would that result in? That's the problem. And if you say refugees without any form of identification are welcome in New Zealand, where do they go first? They go from wherever, whatever country they're in, to Indonesia, to Papua New Guinea, and then they head to Australia. They don't go directly to New Zealand, Ms. Ardern. So you tell me what the answer is. These people who wanted to leave Manus Island are now refusing to go, and from some of the stories I was telling you about last night with allegations that there's sexual abuse going on with the young girls in town, young girls 14, 15 falling pregnant to these refugees, the smuggling of contraband, drugs, and other unwanted items getting on board Manus Island. No wonder they don't want to leave. But what is the solution? What would you do? 1-3-3-5-3 is the number. You'll hear more about that this week. So you've got these refugees and the asylum seekers detained there. And I mentioned this yesterday, the Australian government has been told that there has been some 161 offences, including sexual assault, aggressive behaviour, allegedly committed by the residents at the processing centre. and the incidents were allegedly committed over a period of 4 years. The Australian newspaper reported that refugees used items such as cigarettes and chocolate to lure young girls into sexual acts. Several children were born from the alleged sexual interactions, the papers reported. Other incidents referred to the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary included unlawful entry, property damage and contraband. Now, you either believe that or you don't. It would be, I guess, in Peter Dutton's interest for us to believe that. We're not there. We haven't seen it. These are allegations. So, I don't know. What do you do? What do you believe? 133353 is the telephone number. A bit later this morning, I want to discuss life insurance. I was thinking about this just yesterday, because if you watch the morning talk television programs, you'll see advertorial after advertorial on life insurance, companies trying to lure us into spending our hard-earned to buy life insurance, so the ones we leave behind are left without wanting. And I just wonder, how worthwhile is this? Is it a waste of money? The Herald Sun was talking about this 2 days ago. Apparently older Australians are wasting tens of millions of dollars a year in life insurance they just don't need. Sharp rises in insurance premiums in the past decade, particularly in superannuation funds, have increased the potential wastage as pre-retirees pay their premiums with money that should be diverted into their savings. Baby boomers are most at risk of spending on unnecessary insurance because many no longer have dependent children or a mortgage, and their nest eggs are large enough to cover them financially. Official data shows that Australians paid $15.9 billion for life insurance policies last financial year, and Super Ratings Chairman Jeff Bresham estimates 90% of people with super are paying for life insurance within it. Are we better off, instead of paying those premiums, putting that money into savings or putting it into our super? Do you have life insurance? We won't mention any names. But are you getting your money's worth? Do you believe that you'll be better off? Have you done the sums? Are you better off saving those premiums and investing it in gold or real estate? 133353 is the telephone number. I'm going to talk to the Reverend Jim a bit later on. There is a new initiative. It's a project designed to house people at risk of homelessness. They're soon going to deliver 57 transportable homes across 9 sites in Melbourne's inner west. And if this works, it could be an initiative that will be shared right around Australia. The Victorian Planning Minister, Richard Wynne, has approved the social housing project on Ballarat Road last week. The proponent is Launch Housing. It's a Victoria-based community organisation, and it provides housing and homelessness support services. 57 dwellings for vulnerable Melburnians is valuable in its own right, he says, particularly given the rapid increase in the numbers of people sleeping rough. However, it's the potential for expanding the concept that makes the project exciting. We'll talk about it in detail a little bit later on. Basically, they're transportable homes. They're like portable classrooms, but they'll be able to house homeless people, people who are at risk. Now, what sort of people are they? We were talking to Reverend Jim about this last week. According to the Reverend, and I don't want to misquote him, but there is at this point sufficient accommodation for homeless people, but that accommodation will only receive people who fit a certain parameter, and that is people who are not intoxicated and people who are not under the effect of drugs. And those people who are often turned away. So it's a tricky one, this one. We'll have a look at this. A possible solution to Melbourne's homelessness. It's an experiment. We'll see how it goes. Reverend Jim joining us a bit later on today. 133353 is the telephone number. Look, plenty of other stuff on my mind this morning. I want to talk about an email that I received yesterday. And there were a number of them coming through since last Tuesday, the Melbourne Cup. Emails I've had talking about school children encouraged to take part in Melbourne Cup sweeps at school. Now, obviously, this didn't happen in Victoria, in Melbourne, because it's a public holiday. But the rest of Australia, it was business as usual. And a number of schools were allowing kids to take part in Melbourne Cup sweeps. And a lot of parents have seen this as a step to gambling. Is it? 133353, if your child at school takes part in the classroom sweep, does that encourage children to gamble? Should it be allowed in school? Or is it just the Aussie thing to do on Melbourne Cup Day? And what's next? Teaching kids to play two-up. Believe it or not, the Catholic boarding school that I sometimes refer to allowed us, I remember one Melbourne Cup Day, allowed us to have a sweep. And we had a teacher who showed us, who taught us, he was showing us, he thought, a slice of history, taught us what two-up was all about. Now, I haven't got on to have a gambling problem. But, gee, it's a while ago now, and I was thinking about this when I was reading some of these emails, and I thought, gee, we did that at school. We had a Melbourne Cup sweep at school, Catholic boarding school, and the teacher taught us what two-up was all about, believing he was teaching us history. Let's discuss. 133353, is that appropriate? Is it the Aussie thing to do on Melbourne Cup Day, or in this day and age are we just too politically correct and, I don't know, we wring our hands and say, no, 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 that will teach kids to gamble. I don't know, what do you think? We can talk about that a little bit later this morning as well. Look, plenty on my mind. There'll be plenty on your mind as well. 133353 if there's something that you've been trying to say. If you haven't rung through before, why don't you be a first-time, long-time? Give us a call right now. Jess is ready to take your calls. It's Tuesday, November 14, 2017. My name is Luke. That is Jess out there. Together, we are the Night Shift on the Triple M Network. Basil, good morning to you.
Yeah, g'day, Luke. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
Yeah, thank you. I was just driving home, actually, from my partner's place, and I heard just the tail end of the report about Lilydale and the decorations, and I thought, you know what, conversely to that, I live in a particular street in Blackburn, which is only about 15, 20 minutes away from Lilydale in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne.
Right, thank you for that.
And, yeah, and we have an amazing tradition here, which spans from the late 50s. So it started in 1959, where the kids in the street would have a nativity play, and then they would present this nativity play traditionally on New Year's Eve, and all the street's residents would get together at somebody's backyard. And then from there, after the nativity play, the kids would then walk around from street in the street and knock on doors and get donations and donate it to some sort of a charity.
Wonderful stuff.
It is, and it's amazing because it still continues to this day. Mm. Now, I've been living in this street since the probably late 80s. My two daughters were involved in it. They started as little angels, and they graduated as they got older, of course. You know, they were 5 years old, little angels, and they would graduate to other speaking roles. And they ended up also then running the actual nativity play. And then you pass the baton on as the kids grow up, they move on, other kids in the street continue. And it's fantastic because the community gets together, gets behind it. And honestly, the diversity in our street in terms of the demographics has changed quite considerably since I was here. And so you're getting all sorts of nationalities attending and their children actually participating.
Oh, it's wonderful, so wonderful stuff.
It is. Totally wonderful.
So can you explain to me why Lilydale would put up so many speed blocks for this thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just don't understand it. I can't explain that. I just think the shopkeepers, maybe they are a bit concerned about being politically correct and not offending people. Maybe they're just being a bit tight in their wallets. I don't really know.
Tell me this. You're only 15 minutes away.
Sure.
This is a national radio show, so most of us don't know. Yep. Is Lilydale, does it have a high population of non-Christians?
No, I don't think so.
No,
it's
okay.
The opposite.
Okay. See, I'm just thinking out loud.
Yep. Yep.
So why could they only raise about $1,300? And that was mostly through an online fundraising page and sausage sizzles. Yep. And most of the shopkeepers, according to the Herald Sun, were not forthcoming. And Vic Rhodes putting up all these speed humps. I understand that Vic Rhodes has come back down, but Vic Rhodes actually ordered the volunteers to stump up hundreds of dollars to go ahead with the decorating. Why would you make things so hard for people to Christmas up their neighbourhood?
Yeah, that sort of, it bewilders me a little bit, because Lilydale is actually just on the edge of country Victoria, because it's just a precursor to going to the Yarra Valley. And so it's sort of semi-country, if that makes sense, which is at odds with what I would think the community would want, because usually, you know, country Victoria are right into that sort of thing of tradition and Christmas and everything else. So I really don't have an answer to that, to be honest, Luke.
Yeah, well, I don't know either. And it just got me wondering, Basil, how many other communities around Australia are fighting red tape when it comes to Christmasing up their community?
Yeah, true. And look, we run now, the actual nativity plays run at a park which is in our street, and the council has never had any issues with us actually doing this. Admittedly, we do have an association in the street, the community association, that we make sure that we are covered with public liability, and that's their biggest thing. But they've never said to us, you can't run it, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. They've never given us any issues. And this is the city of Whitehorse.
Yeah. There's a house near me. The suburb is called Eleonora. Mm-hmm. And the bloke who does it, his name's Steve, he's a good man. He runs the news agents just up the road, as a matter of fact. And anyway, for years now, he's been conducting a thing called Christmas at Eleonora. And you should see what he does. I mean, the thousands and thousands of dollars he spent on his lights and his display is unbelievable. And hundreds of people gather at night and they sing Christmas carols. There's food, there's gold coin donations, and it all goes to charity. And he was saying to me the other day, you have to come along and have a look. And I said, well, I'm at work, unfortunately, Steve, when you do this. He said, this is my last year. I said, why? He said, I just can't do it anymore. It's costing me a fortune, and I'm getting a bit old. The effort is just, it's beyond me. And that's going to be sad. That's going to be really sad.
It is. And I think this is where tradition is important, and somebody needs to be able to take up that baton and continue it. And I think this is really what we love in Australia, that traditional aspect of whether it's Christmas or, you know, whether it's Remembrance Day, for example. Stuff like that, we need to keep holding it and keep continuing it.
Yeah, I agree. It'll be very interesting to see. I don't know, maybe we've got a large American presence where I live, I don't know, but you should see the effort that goes into Halloween in my neighbourhood, and it's going to be very interesting to see if just as much effort goes into Christmas.
It is interesting, Halloween. I mean, to me, that's a very commercial thing here, isn't it?
Don't tell me Christmas hasn't become commercial.
No, it is, totally, but this is just another aspect of, it is commercialism, and obviously from America, so it's... one of these things that I guess people like to, you know, do it because they make money out of it.
Yeah, well, anyway, there you are. Listen, thank you so much for your call, Basil.
That's all right. My pleasure.
And nice to know you're listening.
And happy Christmas.
Thank you very... Oh, are you allowed to say that?
Yeah, we can.
You might. You may have offended some people.
Oh, no.
You may have offended some people.
Knock on my door and tell me then to my face.
Yeah, good on you. Thanks, Basil. Bye-bye. Yeah, I wonder, in your neighbourhood, does your neighbourhood go to as much trouble to decorate for Christmas as it does for Halloween? 133353. And have you tried to Christmas up your community and had trouble, come across roadblocks? Give us a call and let us know. 133353. You're listening to The Night Shift here on the Triple M Network. Thinking, Reverend Jim, we need some music for you. I don't know what... So we need some intro music. Like, hallelujah, or something. I don't know. Jess, we'll come up with something, okay? We need an intro for the Reverend Jim.
There'd be a big red beacon going from the Dandenongs in Melbourne because I'd be getting very embarrassed.
Well, that works for me.
Okay, no problems then.
Reverend Jim Reynolds from the Christian Outreach Centre around Australia, good morning to you.
Good morning, Luke. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, very, very good. Lots to talk about this week, lots to talk about. I know you wanted to talk about this... Sheikh or a sheikh. Is it sheikh or sheikh? I mean that respectfully.
Sheikh.
Sheikh. Who says... By the way, this was the bloke that used to be the surfing god. Do you know of him?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Anyway, you've read the story.
Yep.
He is saying that women need to wear a hijab. They need to cover up because men... don't need the distraction of looking at women. Now, he got the sack for saying these things on his Facebook. I don't believe he should have been sacked because we have freedom of religion and freedom of speech in this country. I don't agree at all with what he had to say, but does he have a right to say it?
He absolutely has a right to say it, and it's not uncommon with the Sunni Muslims to preach that. And I actually had a quick listen to some of his sermon that they referred to in the news report. And from the news report, you get about 30 seconds of what he said, and there's a good 45 to 55 minutes of that actual sermon with some commentary underneath it. And basically, he's been talking about that's the way the Quran sees it. While he does promote it, he also is aware that, you know, it is a choice. So a lot of the stuff that's been said has been taken out of context through the story.
Yep.
And the fact is, even if you are a minister, be it a Muslim, be it Jewish, Christian,
Hindu,
we do work, Hindu as well, we work in other occupations as well to either supplement our income or to pay for overseas holidays or whatever we want, we work in other industries. And if we are in our church, people come to see us for our religious teachings.
Yeah.
He has said that in his own mosque. His work should not have anything to say about what he's done because, as he said quite clearly in his Facebook post, I don't talk about it at work. When I'm at work, I'm just myself and I do the job that I'm paid to do. Now, when I'm in the church, I'm different.
Now, how many people around Australia get disciplined or indeed sacked from their jobs because of what they've posted on Facebook? You do have to be careful.
That is true, and that's why a lot of us have separate Facebook accounts. So I have one Facebook account that I use as Reverend Jim, and then I have my own personal one, and I'm very careful on what I post and what will actually go out there. But if I was to put a sermon on to my Facebook account and somebody at my workplace didn't like it, I would be very upset about my own freedoms because I'm acting in another role. It's not like I'm sitting there having a go at someone or, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, my workplace are a bunch of wankers, to actually exercising your own right in a respectful manner, which is what it looks like this guy's done from what I've seen of his preaching and the comments that he made underneath it.
Yeah. And so that people don't say that we're Muslim bashing or we have Islamophobia, I am very concerned about that Kiwi preacher that you and I talked about, Pastor Logan Robertson, who said that he's against gay marriage, and that's fine, but he said he has nothing against gay people getting married as long as a bullet goes through their head the moment they kiss. Now, to me, that's inciting violence, and I'm very much against that. So here I am protesting against something that a man of the Christian cloth is saying, and here I am defending the rights of someone who is Islamic.
But in saying that, that Brisbane preacher could be classed as an extremist for what he has said. What the Muslim cleric has said has been something that's been said by many Sunni Muslims in many different mosques across Australia for many, many years, and it will still continue on because one of their things is that they do like the women to wear the full hijab, but they do also stress that it's a choice. It is part of what they do. There's nothing out of the ordinary for what the Muslim cleric has said, whereas that Christian cleric, the pastor, he's just a jerk and is an extremist. That's the only way I can put it. I mean, you know, if you put him into a Muslim cleric's robes, you would say he's a terrorist, that man. It's as simple as that. The way he speaks, the way he treats people, the way he talks about people, when you listen to his teachings on the internet, he is a terrorist. The only difference is he has a Kiwi accent. This other fella is just doing the usual teachings that Sunnis have done for many, many years.
133353 is the telephone number. Yeah. Is it a fine line between freedom of religion and incitement? I don't agree with what this guy said. He was sacked from his day job for telling his followers women need to wear a hijab so that men can control their sexual urges. Now, I think he has grounds for wrongful dismissal.
I do as well, because there's enough evidence there to say that it's not an uncommon teaching. It's not something that would be seen by that community as an extreme view. Just about any Sunni would say that that's something that we've heard many times before. We can agree, we can disagree. It's kind of a non-issue in a lot of respects. And that's where I'm coming from. What he said has not been out of the extraordinary from anyone else that I've ever spoken to about that issue.
Yeah. The refugees on Manus Island, you probably get a lot of people talking to you about this. We've got nearly 500, about 420 men, I understand, have chosen to remain at the site. Most of them have decided to go and be placed elsewhere. They've decided they're going to live there without food or water or medical supplies. This is completely their choice. They have other places to go. I have read in the Australian newspaper that there have been 161 offences, including sexual assault, assault and aggressive behaviour, allegedly committed by these residents at the processing centre. They were reported to the Australian government by the Papua New Guinea authorities mid-October. The incidents were allegedly committed over a period of 4 years. We are talking about the refugees using items which are provided by the Australian taxpayer, incidentally, such as cigarettes and chocolate, to lure young girls into sexual acts. Apparently, several children have been born from these alleged sexual interactions. Other incidents referred to the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary include unlawful entry, property damage and contraband. Now, apparently, 190 men from the centre are going to travel to a nearby village. So what do we do with these illegal refugees? The New Zealand Prime Minister has said she'll take some, 150. What sort of message does that send to the people smugglers and to other people who want to get to Australia via the back door?
The absolute wrong message. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if they're committing those type of crimes, send them back to where they came from. You know, I've met plenty of refugees in the work that I've done, and one thing that the true refugees that I've met who are in Australia have said is when they got here, they were on the ground, kissing the ground and doing everything they can to make a great life for themselves. They were willing to work hard. It didn't matter what they were going to do. They were going to do it to make a life, not sit there and start selling drugs or start sexually assaulting people and, you know, chucking a tantrum because it took a little bit longer than they expected to get here. And they never even dreamed of getting rid of their documents.
Yeah. If the New Zealand Prime Minister takes 150 of these so-called refugees, the message is, the doors are open again, and the people smugglers will be back in business, the leaky boats will once again hit the water, and how many more souls will be lost at sea?
That's exactly right. And one thing I'm not too sure of, and this is a question I'll ask you, Luke, if they do go to New Zealand and become New Zealand citizens, won't that allow them to come over
yes,
here and work?
Absolutely. Once, if they become New Zealand citizens, they'll be allowed straight back into Australia. And that would be a huge draw card. I don't think the new Prime Minister of New Zealand understands all that. Tell me about these movable houses and vacant government blocks. It's a new way to tackle homelessness in Victoria. If it works, it's an initiative that may well be taken up right around the country. What do you know about it?
I know that we want to get it up and running, and I know that it's going to be a fantastic thing if we do, but the biggest problem is where we're going to put them. Now, the money side of things is fairly well sorted. One of the biggest landholders in Victoria is Vic Roads, and they hold the land if they need to extend roads and do all the stuff that you know, the roads people need to do. But the problem that we're finding is where do we put these places? Because I'll give you an example. Now, I've said to you before that we have a garage here that's set up like a little unit and we use it for people who need help. But we don't tell anyone who's in the local area. because all we need is one idiot to start jumping up and down and saying, what about the children and everything like that? Our whole program is out the window.
It's always
the NIMBYs that destroy these good ideas.
Yeah. Not in my backyard is what the NIMBY is. Not in my backyard. So everyone feels very sorry for the homeless, people who are sleeping rough, but no one wants them living near them.
That's exactly it. And now, look, you can have a street of 100 people, and 99 people will say, yep, not a problem, we want to help these guys. All you need is one dickhead, and the whole thing's screwed. And most of the listeners who are listening tonight, because they hear me quite often talking about the homeless, will be going, I don't care if they're in my area. That's great, but there's always that one idiot, and you can probably think of an idiot in your street that would jump up and down and say that.
Yep.
And that's where the biggest problem is going to lie. And they've hinted at that at the article. And, you know, we've just got to find those right places where we can put these people, and also to work out what kind of people we're going to put into them. Because we're not just going to say to somebody who's in a shop front, okay, here's a place and there you go. There's a lot of rehab that needs to be done. You need to look at, are they on alcohol? Are they using drugs? Is this going to be a full-time prospect? Because you don't want to take a bed away from somebody who might need it. You put somebody who's not going to utilize it properly, then that's one less bed that we have. So there's a lot to work out on how it's actually going to run, what type of assessments will run on people before they actually get into these places and, you know, then transition them in through Department of Housing and all the other steps that we normally take. So there's a little bit more to work out, but our biggest hurdle is the NIMBYs.
Not in my backyard. And sometimes NIMBYs have a point. By the way, I'm talking to the Reverend Jim. 133353 is the telephone number if you'd like to take part in the conversation. You'd be hard-pressed to find an Australian who doesn't agree that we need more public housing, that we need more housing that can take people who are down on their uppers, lower socioeconomic groups, but no one wants public housing in their suburb. And the fact of the matter is, and I'm not saying everybody in public housing is a criminal, but there is a high criminal element in public housing areas. There's unemployment. There's high amounts of drug taking. And so do the NIMBYs have a point when it comes to public housing? Would you want suddenly a public housing estate set up in your neighbourhood?
For me personally, it wouldn't worry me in the slightest. I've never had a problem with that at all. What I do think that we do need to start doing is looking at how we're actually spreading out our cities, because there are plenty of areas out there that could be utilised that could bring in employment. Right now, if we have a look at Melbourne, just it's around about 90% of our state government services are in the city. We could be moving some of them out into the country areas, and, you know, then we're going to have, you know, people moving out there, and, you know, also spread out the people who need housing, put some of the council houses out there as well, and start moving people out and attracting people out to the country areas.
But if they're unemployed, what are they going to do?
Well, if they're unemployed and they're in the country areas, people will always find stuff to do. But if we start moving jobs out there as well, because a lot of people aren't going to leave Melbourne to go to a job in, say, Bendigo. So you can actually employ people if you take the jobs out there and start moving some of these council houses out there. You can start changing the system. Right now, we're stagnant. And until we actually move things around, we're not going to lose that stagnant feel.
Yeah. All right, then. Listen, just quite quickly to finish with this morning. Apparently, Lilydale residents in Melbourne, they hit a Christmas Grinch when it came to putting up their Christmas decorations. They had to face massive fees to decorate. They had trouble raising money for their Christmas decorations. They only raised about $1,300. Vic Roads were charging them all sorts of fees to put up the decorations. I understand they've now backed down. But have you heard of other areas around your area or around Australia through the Christian outreach centres where people have found roadblocks when it comes to decorating for Christmas? Are people not willing to help or donate because they're worried about offending people? What's your reaction been?
Well, I'm just trying to remember. I know Lilydale very well. I live about 10 minutes away from Lilydale, and they've usually just had the as you go through the main street, because it's one of the main routes to the Yarra Valley Wine District. So it is a very busy road, so I can understand why Vic Roads needs to do a lot of the assessments. It's the first time I've ever heard of them charging. But a lot of the council areas are just starting to do their Christmas decorations. Fairly soon, Melbourne will have a lot of theirs up. There hasn't really been too many stories that I know of where Christmas decorations have been taken down. It's only just starting now, so in the next couple of weeks, I might be able to answer that question.
Yeah, apparently they were going to charge... They've only raised $1,300, and that's through sausage sizzles and a fundraising page. It's not a lot of money. And Vic Roads were going to charge them $500 to close off a lane of traffic on the Maroondah Highway. But it's very, very interesting that they're finding it hard to get donations from the local shops. Apparently there was a real estate agent which gave $500, but people aren't giving like they used to, and I just wonder why.
That I'm not 100% sure I can answer. I mean, I know Lily Dale. I know it very well. Your story's the first I've heard of it.
Okay, so well, I'll let you investigate. Apparently, this group door-knocked more than 70 traders, and most did not want to donate. Maybe money's hard to come by. Maybe, I don't know. Or maybe they're afraid of offending people. I don't know. It's just an interesting observation. 133353 is the telephone number. Just quickly, Daniel is online with a question for you. Reverend?
Yep. How you going there, mate?
Good.
Hey, good, mate. I remember you were making a point about moving the services for homeless people outside of the city. And it jogged my memory. I remember hearing or reading somewhere, I just wanted to hear get your opinion on it, that a good portion of the homeless people in the Melbourne CBD or the area there are not necessarily from Melbourne or Victoria for that matter, but because of the quality of the services that they have, they are coming in from interstate for those services.
Yeah, you've actually said that, Reverend Jim. You said if you're going to be homeless anywhere, be homeless in Melbourne.
Yep. When I was saying moving the services out, I was actually talking about start building more public housing out in the rural areas. But you are correct. We do have the best services, so we are getting people from other major capital cities coming down to Melbourne. So, yes, the homeless are living in the CBD, but the problem is we've got to transition them from being homeless to getting them into government housing, which takes a few steps. We've got about... it's about 6 weeks of living on the street before you can't just pick someone up and put them back into a house, and then we need to do rehab and the like. So there's a lot of work. But, Daniel, when I was talking about the housing, I was actually talking about housing going out to the regional areas more so than kicking them out.
No, I understand that. I was just querying that as well. But I'm sure there'll be rural areas in Victoria as well that need require workers. I'm not just talking farm workers and things like that, but actual skilled labourers and skilled people that some of these homeless people are legitimately, you know, skilled people that they can be housed in areas where they require their skills are required anyway, so that solves the problems of employment for these people as well.
What percentage of homeless people you've encountered, Reverend Jim, would be skilled labour?
Skilled labour? That's a bit of a hard one. I've had plenty of builders, electricians, plumbers who I've met out on the street, just the same as I've had bus drivers, lawyers, and doctors living out on the street.
You've had lawyers and doctors living on the street?
Oh, yeah.
Are you serious?
Absolutely.
You've had doctors, homeless doctors?
Yes, I have, yes. Yes. They've got the gambling bug and the alcohol bug, and they just lose their whole profession.
So, can I put this to you, Reverend? And thanks for your call, Daniel. Can I put this to you then? Homeless people, you say 6 weeks living on the street before you can put them into a house and they have to be assessed. If they have addictions, gambling, drugs, alcohol, whatever, or they're trying to address mental health issues, that's the sort of help and rehabilitation they need.
Well, that's exactly it. When I say the 6 weeks, what I mean is after 6 weeks of being out on the street, you become, it's a very old term, but battle fatigue.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're living in a hyper-aware state, and if we take someone who's in that state and put them into a room, they tend to freak out a lot because they don't know the new sounds and you've got to slowly integrate them in. As far as those mental health assessments that would be done, they'll be done by other organisations like the Living Room, who would get them into drug and alcohol counselling, gambling counselling, anything that they need, and they'll go through those programs before they're even eligible to go into one of the demountable houses. So that's why I say there's a lot of work to do before we can just start filling those houses up.
Yeah, all right. Look, we've covered a fair bit here this morning. It's always good to talk to you, always enlightening. And we'll talk again soon. You take care. Keep up the good work.
No worries, mate. You have a good night.
And you try and sleep, all right?
I'll try.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Thanks for that. Bye-bye. There you go. Lots to talk about. The Reverend Jim. Mitch from Adelaide. G'day. Mitch.
Yeah, mate. How you going?
I'm very good, Mitch. What's up?
Not much. Just sitting on the tractor, actually.
You're on a tractor? Yeah. You're on a farm right now, are you?
Yeah, sure am.
Yeah, what sort of farm is it?
Just crop farm, mate.
Crops?
Yeah, just pure crop.
And you're are you sowing or are you ploughing or what are you doing?
No, we're harvesting.
You're harvesting your crops. What is it you're harvesting right now?
Barley at the moment.
Yeah?
I actually rang up twice last year about the same time because I was about this time an hour or two because I was bored. Yeah.
We didn't start till the 12th of December.
So, or it might have been a little bit later than that. Might have been in December.
You might have rung on the 13th of December.
Yeah, I think I rang, was one of the first callers, actually.
Okay, I think I remember you. You're only very young, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'm 17 now.
You're 17? So you rang me when you were 16?
Pretty much, yeah.
And you were working with your dad on a farm.
Well,
Yeah, and it's not your farm. Your dad manages it or something.
No, I'm just working with my uncle.
Your uncle, that's right. That's right. I do remember you, Mitch. How you been?
Yeah, good, mate.
Good. What did you want to talk about?
Well, because I'm on a farm, obviously, I was thinking about animal welfare there.
Yeah, well if I can, for people who have only joined us, the RSPCA are really upset that more people who are found guilty of animal cruelty aren't getting jail sentences. In fact, just 27 people out of 614 people convicted of animal cruelty over the past 5 years received any jail time. The judiciary are letting people walk, even serious cases of animal cruelty. That's what we were talking about earlier. Now, you go on.
I was looking at it from a different angle here. There's been big talk around, like I'm a country kid, obviously, like my bull riding. They talk a fair bit about bull riding being against the animal welfare. You know where I'm coming from here?
I have heard that, yes. The animal welfare protesters don't like rodeos or rodeos at all. They say it's cruel to the animal.
Yeah.
I've come to
put a little bit of statistics to that. I'll say that I personally agree, like bull riding, yeah, it does more damage to the person that's riding the cow, clearly. But those cows are bred for the sport. They are fed like kings, pretty much, of how big they are. And they only get transported on the truck 10 hours, like 10 hour stints, and then after that they get off for 12 hours. So they're not travelling long hours.
Yeah.
So they're not being cruel. But then this relates back to what you were saying about the Melbourne Cup chat there just before.
Yes.
About, I'm not sure if you were saying it last night I was listening, was it, or I heard it from somewhere else, about horses dying in, like, Melbourne Cup races, like the horses.
Yeah, no, I didn't talk about it, but I know that there was talk of it. I'll see if Jess can find this story. Yeah, there was a in one of the papers last week, there was a story about the number of horses that die either during or immediately after the running of the Melbourne Cup, and it made national news headlines. Now, people involved in the racing industry said it was all crap, but I remember that story. We didn't talk about it here. This is the
I just remember that linking back to the animal welfare thing. I don't know too much about on that one, but yeah, on the I was looking on the other side of it. I wanted to know what your thought of what, you know, rodeos and stuff are, like what you thought, if you think it's cruel or if they do anything wrong.
Well, I spent a lot of time in regional New South Wales on the radio, and I've been to a couple of rodeos. Did you say rodeo or rodeo, Mitch?
Potato.
Okay. And I've been there when animal welfare protesters have been waving their signs. Now, I've seen the bulls ridden. The bull obviously is bucking furiously because he doesn't want anybody on his back.
Yeah, and it's because if you notice how the cowboy holds like one hand,
yes,
that strap that goes underneath,
yes,
he doesn't want that on his stomach. That's why it's pulled tight. Well, it's not tight, but that's agitating the cow. And that's what's making him go crazy.
Right. And there were reports from some animal welfare protesters that that rope was also pulled under his nads.
Yeah, well, I have heard rumours that they do that
to really agitate the bull. Now,
agitate the bull. But
now, if you've got a rope pulling on your nads...
you're not going to like that.
You're not going to like it. I would say that's cruel.
Yeah, I would agree that... Like, what they call the PBR, the professional bull riding.
Yeah.
That's, I'd say that they've got their backside covered with all that and that they would be doing the right thing. But it's more the country rodeos that you'd be a little worried about. But I just don't have an issue with it. Like, the animal, what you were saying before, there was a few animal incidents of, what you were saying before, towing something behind a motorbike there.
Yeah, it was a ewe. It was towed for 100 metres behind a quad bike. All its left side had been scraped away. A crow had taken one of its eyes and the sheep was left to die in a paddock. The perpetrators pleaded guilty to cruelty and they were let off with a fine.
Like, people like that should be...
sent to jail.
Should be sent to jail.
And they're
I
not.
That.
Hey, listen, I tell you what I'll do, Mitch, because you've raised an interesting point. We have a lot of listeners around Australia living in rural areas where the rodeos or the rodeos go. Why don't I try and find a spokesperson for the NRMA? Oh, sorry, the NRMA, listen to me. The NRMA. The RSPCA. And see what how they feel about rodeos.
Yeah, that would be great. Because, personally, I live country, I go to rodeos all the time. I wanted to defend them because you hear all the time, oh, rodeos are bad, rodeos are bad. Like, you go to rodeos, I reckon it'd be more dangerous for the people at the rodeo getting pissed off their heads than what it is for the cow being there. Like, you know, so I'm trying to just defend the rodeo side of it here with, like, all those welfare people that stick up and say, you know, hey, rodeos are bad. I don't reckon they are because I don't believe that the cow itself or the bull is well looked after. Because it's a bit like it's a race car. You're not going to keep it, you know, shitty or anything. Like, you want your animal in pristine condition to go out and perform its max capacity to put on for a show. Like, it's not harming the animal in any formal way. So,
I'm not an expert. Let me contact this fellow from the RSPCA, Andrew Clatches. I'll try and find him today, see if he can come on the program, and we'll find out where the RSPCA stands on rodeos, okay?
Yeah, no, that'd be great. I'd like to hear what a professional person thinks about that.
Yeah, okay. Now, you are a man of the land, Mitch.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Okay, do you deal with sheep?
Oh, sheep to a degree, yeah.
Do you how many sheep would you have on your property there?
Oh, we don't have any here on the one I'm working at, but I go off and contract
okay,
and help other people.
Okay, you know about sheep. for those uninitiated listening to us, people who have never been out of the smoke, how about you tell our audience what mulesing is?
Yeah, well, mulesing is a hard one. Like, you do take the skin off the back of the sheep.
With shears.
With shears. So you do rip one layer of skin off, or you would, if you want to say, or a few.
That's exactly what you do.
Yep.
Mulesing, M-U-L-S-I-N-G. Is that how you spell it? Mulesing.
Yeah, I reckon that sounds about right.
Yeah, and you get a very, very sharp pair of shears. They've got a pointed edge. And you go up the backside, the back leg of the sheep, and with one swoop, you take off a layer of skin so that it forms a scab. Therefore, wool won't grow there, and it stops the sheep from suffering fly strike.
So at the point of time, it puts sheep through suffering, yes, correct. But in the long run, you're putting the sheep through, like, preventing a great deal of pain.
That's right. So,
I've got friends who his mum is a professional mulser, and she does this all the time. She's looked into other methods of mulesing, and no other method is good enough than this. Like,
no other method's this efficient. It's a horrifying thing to see, and if you're not used to it, it's very, very confronting. But if you've ever seen a sheep suffering from fly strike or a sheep that has been fly blown, where the fly buries itself into the skin of the sheep and lays its eggs and its maggots, and then they eat on that flesh of the sheep, that is something else altogether. And mulesing stops that, correct?
That stops that, correct. The animal welfare do say, yes, that is bad, we need to stop that, but does everyone want a lamb in the world? Does everyone want wool, like, to put in their blankets? Well, that's one way. We have to do that to proceed so you people can have those things.
Yeah, well, there you are. That's it. How far does your conscience go? A lot of people love their lamb and beef. They don't want to think about how it gets to their plate, though. Mitch?
Yeah, well, it all starts here, and I don't think most people understand it.
No, so, I think you're probably right. Mitch, I've got to go now. It's been...
That's all right, but I just wanted to get my point across and basically stand up for the farmers out here. All working hard.
They are working hard. Mitch, have you had much rain?
No, but there's some coming later tonight.
Later tonight. And whereabouts out of Adelaide are you?
Balaclava, so we're about an hour or so north of Adelaide.
An hour north of Adelaide, and there you are on the farm with your uncle, sitting on a tractor.
Don't doubt me, I'll ring again, don't you worry.
I hope you do, Mitch, 17 years of age on the land. All right, good on you, Mitch. Thank you, mate.
Too easy, catch ya.
Bye-bye. G'day, Joe.
G'day, Luke, how you are?
Mate, I'm okay, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good, mate. Just waiting to go home from work.
What's work?
Qantas.
Good on you. What do you do at Qantas?
Engineering.
Yeah, fantastic. You enjoy? How long you been with them?
27.
Oh, so you've only been there a little while.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. What's this new Dreamliner like?
I don't know, mate. I haven't even seen it, to be honest with you.
Oh, right. You'll be fixing it soon.
Yeah, not me. I do the logistics. The logistics side of it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so you're still at work, are you?
Yeah, mate, still here.
All right, then I'll let you keep going in a minute. What did you want?
I might just want to have a chat about being expelled from school.
Were you expelled?
Yeah, mate. It was year seven, and I went from a public school to a Catholic school.
Yeah.
And I was a bit of a hooligan as a kid, and I had the long hair and stuff, and it was me. Second day at the school, and just sitting there and having a bit of a laugh with me mates, and the brother came past and he grabbed me by the back of the hair and he's pulled me back, and I was falling off my chair, and my instant reaction was pick up the chair and throw it at him, and he tried to block it, and I've broken his arm.
Oh no, so, that's not good.
Yeah, that was my Catholic debut in school.
Wow.
Yeah.
You lasted one day.
Yeah, I think it was the second day.
Oh, God, you got to the second day. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So, but he's pulled your hair.
Yeah, he's pulled my hair.
And you reacted.
Yeah, as I do it, you know, back then I did, you know.
I remember when I was at this boarding school, there was this bloke who actually pulled a knife on one of the priests, and there was a kerfuffle, and it sorted out, and he stayed at school. I mean, can you imagine that today?
Oh, yeah, he'd be locked up today.
He'd be locked up today, but yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he did, I don't even think he got suspended. He might have had special problems, I'm not sure.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, can you imagine that today?
Yeah, he'd be locked up for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So that was your Catholic school education, come and gone in one day.
Come and gone in one day.
You see, and there's the lesson, folks. You can get expelled from a Catholic school and end up an aeronautical engineer. Anyone can succeed in this life if you put your if you put your mind to it. Well done.
Yeah.
All right. Good on you. Thanks for that.
Oh, Luke. See you, mate.
See you, mate. Bye bye. 133353. Good day, Gary.
Yeah. How are you, Luke?
Yeah, good. What you got a story for me?
Yeah, I didn't get expelled because they couldn't expel me. I was one of those special needs kids. But so they used to put me on playground isolation because I used to do a bit of money collecting for the more nefarious people around town. So
you were a debt collector, were you? You were.
Well, no, I was more of a convincer or a coercer than a, you know. And but the best thing was at school, there was no police involved. It would just be with the principal or whatnot. So, whereas if it happened on the street, there was an issue. So
hang on. Anyway. Hang on. Let's get this story straight. You're at what year are you in when this happened?
About year eight. So.
That's only second form.
Yeah.
Year eight. Okay. And you were a debt collector. How did it work? Tell us the story.
Well, what I do is in the afternoons, certain people around town, I go and see them, just get a list of names. And then the next day at school, we'd just have a little chat and make sure everything got sorted out.
So the people who owed money, that was fellow students?
Yes, yeah.
So were you...
And these older people couldn't do anything to the kids, you know what I mean? But when you're at school, it was just a playground fight.
So you, at the age of year eight, were you big for your age?
Yeah, well, I'm not a small bloke, so...
But you could obviously fight?
Yeah, I'd never come out scarred, put it that way. I've done a job pretty well, and once people know that you're doing the job all right, you seem to get more and more clients.
Yeah, wow.
So, but by the time I got to year 10, I'd had enough of school, so I left.
And what did you go on and do?
Pretty much the same thing.
You were a strong-arm debt collector when you left school.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've come from a small town, so it was pretty easy. If you see me coming, you either ran or just gave me the cash.
What was the town? Can you name it or not? You don't have to.
Yeah, I can. Foster.
Foster. Okay, that's on the north coast of New South Wales. Foster Tuncurry. It's a twin town, correct?
Yeah.
A beautiful town, right on the coast.
Yep. And it's still there now, so.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. So you used to go around and collect money.
Yeah, or even if somebody's bike got stolen and they knew who did it or something like that. I was always given little jobs like that to make sure I got their bike back.
Take us through it. Tell us how you did it.
Well, as soon as someone was identified, it was pretty easy.
And what would you do?
Yeah. Well, they see me coming. As I said, they either gave it to me or, you know, copped it. And at school, the thing, like I said, they can't involve the police. And because I was a special needs kid, you know, they always took pity on me. And so in the end, I got playground isolation and had to sit outside the principal's office.
But you never got expelled?
No.
Playground isolation because you were a special needs kid.
Yeah.
Are you still a special needs kid, Gary?
Oh, very special, yeah. I can tell you. I'm touched, put it that way.
What do you do for a living today?
Oh, I just get rid of documents out of computers and that sort of thing. you know, confidential information.
So you are a colourful character. Is that what you're telling me?
No. Well, you can make your own judgment. But no, I just thought it was funny when old mate talked about being a bookie. I thought, yeah, that used to go on in our school too. And yeah, same thing if people didn't pay around football training and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, we were Aussie rules as well. We weren't rugby league.
There you are. All right. Thanks.
Anyway,
Thank
good
you,
on
mate.
You, Luke.
Yeah, good on
Love
you.
Show, mate.
Thank
See
you,
ya.
Thank you, Gary, the special needs kid who's now a special needs adult. Alan from Bunbury, g'day.
How are you, Luke?
I'm good, Alan. What do you got?
I was expelled for a day because I decided to shave my front of my head and leave the back all hairy.
Why did you do that?
I was trying to give myself a haircut.
Yeah.
Yes, and that was a Catholic school.
Okay. You got well, you weren't expelled, you were suspended.
Yeah, and basically, even the dog just looked at me like, what the heck did you do? So, yeah, and then when I went back to school, I was totally bald, and, yeah, the females were loving it, rubbing my head and going, oh, that feels good.
Wow. So, yeah. They reckon that bald-headed men have more testosterone. And that,
yeah.
and that women are attracted to bald men, but completely bald, not Jason Alexander, George Costanza bald.
Not
George Brandis bald, but Peter Garrett bald.
Yeah, sadly, I've got too much hair to be Peter Garrett bald now.
Well, I mean, if I went like George Brandis or Jason Alexander, I'd shave it. I reckon the little tufts of hair on either side look stupid. I'd actually shave the whole thing, wouldn't you?
Most likely, yes.
Yeah. I want to hear from women. Women listening to the program this morning, are bald men more attractive? Yul Brynner, Telly Savalas, Peter Garrett, Michael Jordan, except Michael Jordan. Does Michael Jordan count? Because he shaved his head. Jess, are you really bored if you choose to be bored by shaving? She's talking to people. I want to hear from women. Do women find bald-headed men more attractive because somehow secretly they know that those men have got more testosterone? 133353 is the telephone number. Thanks for your call, Alan. I'll let you keep going. Sam, good day.
Hello.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
Good, thanks. Luke, how are you?
Good, mate. Where are you?
Airlie Beach.
My missus has just been up to Airlie Beach for a week. She got back Saturday.
Oh, nice.
She was staying with a lady that used to be our next door neighbour who's bought up there. She loves it.
Yeah. The tuk-tuk rider.
She is. She's a tuk-tuk rider.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sam, what's up?
I was just talking about the gambling with the young kids. Not gambling with the young kids, but like with the Melbourne Cup things at schools and sweepstakes and whatnot.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm only 24. I did sort of sweepstakes thing, but there was no money involved with the class. It'd be pick a ticket out of the hat, and then that'd be your horse for the day, and blah, blah, blah. You get a prize if your horse won. It wasn't, no one gambled. It was just all random. But a thing about gambling and youth today is that a lot of people don't realize mobile games and games that are coming out with something called loot boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially you pay real money for like a cosmetic upgrade, like a costume for your character or something. But recently they've been getting worse and worse, and it's targeted at young kids and giving them gambling addictions early on, because essentially you're gambling for, oh, I need the best loot, so they're going to spend their mum's credit card or whatever, or their new credit card on this stuff. And it's actually playing. They've got little algorithms and stuff to go, oh, here's because you bought this first pack, we'll give them this nice item, but it encourages them to buy more and things like that. And it's targeting kids as young as 12, like mobile games and everything.
And they become addicted. But they're actually using real money, are they?
Yeah. They're using real money, like credit cards, things like that. You buy it with loot. It's called loot boxes and things like that, loot crates and things like that. Like some of the most popular games are using it today to gain more money and, like, expand on the game, but they're not really expanding on games anymore. And unfortunately, it's targeting youth pretty badly because, well, it's 100% gambling on it.
Yeah.
And because of video games, new games, like the new Star Wars game, it's coming out very soon. And Darth Vader doesn't come unlocked with it. You can't be Darth Vader until you play 40 hours into the game or you pay for real money.
Hang on, you got to play for 40 hours or you pay for him.
Or you pay for him, yeah.
Do you know anything about Candy Crush?
Yes, same sort of deal. Like you pay to keep going and things like that.
Now, my missus, the Minister for War and Finance, She's obsessed with Candy Crush. It started 3 years ago, and I thought it would just be a fad. And that's the reason why she won't get her own Facebook. She piggybacks off mine because it's got something to do with getting lives on Candy Crush. Do you understand?
Yeah, yeah.
And different people on Candy Crush via Facebook ask for lives. Is that correct?
I think so. But you can, not super, yeah.
But you can actually pay for lives.
Yes. Yeah. You'll find people rack up heaps of bills. One common problem is like when a toddler or something gets their hands on the parent's phone, downloads a game, starts paying for it, and uses the credit card or whatever that's saved on for, say, music. Parents don't have their like password saved onto their phone, like with Apple iTunes or things like that. The credit card's ready to go. They'll load up an app like Candy Crush or something like that, and they'll blow through $300 in that day just playing that game all day. And you can do a one-time refund of it, saying my kid did it, not me, and then that'll be that. But you can't like continue on with the games and things.
God, here's something else I need to look into.
Yeah, yeah, it's really. Really odd. It's video game companies and just companies in general have been starting to bring in all these loot boxes and things like that and encouraging gambling in youth, and it's pretty scary, actually. It's you got a whole group of probably about between age 10 and 25 guys and girls just addicted to buying loot crates and things like that.
Well, I had no idea.
And one thing is they're called whales, in a sense. They're what, like, companies that go, oh, we'll go to them. Whales essentially have a giant wallet, and they'll just keep paying and keep paying and paying and paying thousands of dollars into these mobile games like Clash of Clans and all that sort of stuff.
But you pay all this money, and you don't win money back. You just are able to continue to play the game.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like a poker machine where you hope to get money out of it.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. This
thing you're talking about is even more ridiculous. It gives you permission to keep playing a stupid game. You don't even get money.
Exactly.
It's, holy Jesus.
It's and it's targeting youth is everywhere, like kids everywhere. I think they really, it started on the mobile market with like Candy Crush, Clash of Clans, and all that sort of stuff, and it's just gone into new like big games coming out, like the new Star Wars and the new Lord of the Rings game that just came out. It's a single player game, but for some reason you need to have loot crates,
I had no idea. I have to talk to Trevor Long about it. Listen,
all good.
Thanks for your call, Sam.
Yep, all good. Thought I'd give you something else to think about.
Yeah, I love that. I love it when people do that. Give us a call, 1-333-53, if you know what Sam's talking about. So it is it's a remarkable form of addiction, isn't it? Gambling.
It is.
It's gambling, but you don't get a monetary refund. You just get to keep playing a stupid game.
Yep.
Holy dooly.
Yeah, and I think it's just weird. In Australia, I notice it really badly because you got all these ads around the footy season going, punters, punters, punters. And it's just, like I said, I just grow up and I've seen everyone around me, oh, I'll throw $100 in the pokey machine, and it's everyone doing it. Oh,
I once had a person ring me who told me they had a poker machine gambling addiction.
Yep.
And they said that half of the addiction was for the monetary refund, for getting cash out of the machine.
Yep.
But the other half was the reward you got when the features light up. Now, how's that? That's basically what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, that's the same case. It's you buy, say, 50 loot boxes from a game, 50 card packs or whatever, and you'll get, like, one or two good ones out of it, and then you've got probably over 100 items that are useless to you.
Wow. All right. Listen, thanks for your call, Sam. You have indeed given us something else to talk about.
All good. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. 1-333-53 is the number if you can add to that.